everybody. What's going on? Welcome to Commander Cast. Commander Cast is a weekly EDH / Commander podcast about community, strategy, and technology, and it's available each week on QuietSpeculation.com, MTGCast.com, and of course our home site, CommanderCast.com. My name is Andy, aka Ghosts, and I'm the primary host of Commander Cast. I am the director and producer of the show. I do all the technical stuff behind the scenes, and I'm just a Commander enthusiast like many of you, and I decided to start a podcast kind of on a whim to connect with other Commander players around the world, and as well to provide them with some kind of resource and representation on MTGCast, and here we are today. As far as I know, we're the only Commander-oriented podcast that's available on the network, and our goal is to provide quality content once a week to Commander players, divided up into three sections. One on community, which is things that people are talking about, issues related to the game and the player base, so on. Oftentimes it's peripheral things that don't really fit into our next segment, which is strategy, where we discuss things that you can actually do in the game to become a better player. And then the final segment is one about technology, where we talk about specific card interactions, deck types, and lesser known cards in our very popular secret tech segment. So if you are listening to this and you've never heard Commander Cast before, welcome. This is a sampler episode, so this should give you an idea of what we're all about and what the average show sounds like. It consists of a variety of segments that have been taken from episodes throughout the show's history that should give you some insight into the kind of grab bag that a typical episode can represent. If you like what you hear, head over to CommanderCast.com, where you can find a full back catalog of all the episodes we've done up to date, as well as a variety of excellent other work that is done by the rest of our staff, many of whom are writers. While CommanderCast started off as a podcast, now it's much more. We have a bunch of writers on the website and so on, so if you have any interest in what you're hearing now, you'll probably also be interested in some of the really great content that the authors are cranking out over at CommanderCast.com. So, enough with the introductions. To kick off the sampler, I have the same segment we've kicked off many of our podcasts with, called the Free For All Roundtable. And in this, it's a roughly 10-minute debate segment. And in it, we each just present our views and defend them. We attack others' views on current issues that the EDH community is facing. And then we always sum it up with a single word representing our thoughts at the end of the 10 minutes. This particular Free For All Roundtable is from Season 4, Episode 6, one where I had Neil, also known as Wrong Way Go Back from WrongWayGoBack.com, and you can find his articles on QuietSpeculation.com.
Hi, everyone. I'm Neil.
And CommanderCast regular contributor Justin.
Hey, everybody. This is Justin.
And our Free For All Roundtable is over the contentious issue of Fast Mana.
So the Free For All Roundtable today is about Fast Mana. Fast Mana is pretty contentious in the EDH community. Fast Mana are all those very low-cost artifacts such as Sol Ring, Mana Crypt, that come down very early and can give someone a very fast start in the game, pushing them ahead before anyone else has had much of an opportunity to play. Today we're discussing Fast Mana. Are they too good? Are they okay? Are they damaging? Anyone have any thoughts?
Well, right off the bat, I just want to say that, like most discussions on what's okay and what isn't for the format, it's just kind of increasingly difficult to come down on one side or the other for me, because the answer for everything is just personal moderation, right? If we accept the kind of rules committee philosophy, which is one I do. But from a mechanical standpoint, like, all this shit is busted. Like, the worst offenders, like the Grim Monoliths and the Sol Rings and the Mana Crypts and the Mana Vaults, like, if this was a technical format, there would be no reason to let these be played. They're unfair. They don't really promote more interesting games. They increase the variance to like such a high degree that it's really easy for one player to just blow another out based on who draws what. So I don't really like those cards in that element. But for Commander, which is a format that isn't intended to be like a technical skill testing format, I think this is a good format for them, because it's the only format where they have an okay home. And I like to see these cards just played for the nostalgia and for the cool factor, because they are part of Magic's history.
That's very true. I think that these are like... The Fast Mana cards that are very appealing to a lot of people, particularly because if you don't play Vintage, like, you'll never play your Mana Crypt, and you'll never play your Mana Vault, and these kind of, like, a lot of the Fast Mana cards that people play, you'll never really get to play unless you play Vintage or play the Mini DH. At the same time, they are very powerful, they lead to very powerful plays, but in EDH, I think most of the plays which kill the table, are the most dominating type of plays, are... not necessarily ones that get enabled by artifact mana. Sometimes they can be, but a lot of things like playing like Avengers, Endicar, and Genesis Wave and things like that, like, are, can be enabled by artifact mana, but are not as much so as like other formats' powerful plays are. So artifact mana can accelerate you very quickly, but can also leave you much more vulnerable to particularly white sweepers. Kerman's Vengeance and Austere Command come to mind. Artifact mana ultimately just is a lot more vulnerable than mana-based, than land-based mana. So my personal preference is for land-based ramp, but I've definitely seen artifact mana be very, very powerful, obviously. So
I think it's funny that you mentioned two things there. One was green and one was the white sweepers. Do you think maybe artifact mana is the only thing keeping mono-green in check? And two, are artifact sweepers a way to, say, abuse cheap land destruction, such as the two white-white land destruction that you often see in the weenie strategies, to be able to get around that if you're properly prepared?
To respond to your thing on green, I think that this is one of the only things that let other colors fight the out-of-control ramping that green has access to, just because of the nature of being an eternal format. You can run every good ramp spell that's ever been printed, basically. And that's a lot of good ramp spells. So it's very easy for the green player to just win by virtue of out-tempoing players. Like, when people talk about how time walks are obnoxious in Commander, no one talks about how the virtual time walks from obnoxious ramp is roughly equivalent, but it is. Like, how many turns ahead of other people are you getting when you have this cascade of ramp from the turn one Sol Ring to the turn two Explosive Vegetation and so on? Like, it builds on itself. And then by the time that you're able to play a 6-mana spell on turn 3 and your opponents are still making their third land drop, you might as well have just played a bunch of early time walks. So I totally agree with you on that, Neil. I think that the artifact mana does kind of serve as a leveler to the playing field with the green. But something I mentioned there earlier as well is the cascade of mana acceleration. And I think that's what makes the fast mana particularly broken for decks that actually aim to abuse it in an optimal way, I suppose is the expression. Is the fact that when you have access to all of these awesome mana rocks, that's when things really fall apart, because they build on each other. And you can kind of put together this machine of mana production from just these low-cost mana rocks that get you so far ahead that, yeah, if your opponents are running these white sweepers, but where do they start as in terms of a mana cost? They start relatively high for most of the ones that are commonly played. And by that time, it's a lot of the time often too late. So these fast mana rocks, they're usually used in the most kind of abusive decks as well, in my experience. Like, everyone runs Sol Rings now because they're in the Commander product. But the decks where they're truly problematic are usually using pretty broken strategies anyway, and this is just an enabler to get them to that point even quicker.
Well, I've been playing a little bit on the Modo 1v1 queues, and I think the day that they started up the first three queues I jumped into, my opponent was playing Arkham Dagsum.
Mm-hmm.
And straight out the bat, they're like, turn one, Island Sol Ring, turn to Arkham, straight into, you know, I think it was Winter Orb, Darksteel, Citadel type of thing. And that's a pretty difficult start for most decks to be able to handle.
Yeah, and that's what I would do if I was playing for prizes too. Like, why wouldn't you? They're giving you access to these tools that are clearly not fit for a truly competitive environment. And by that, I don't mean that they're not good enough. I mean the polar opposite. They're way too good and they're skill reducing. So I don't really think that anyone should support these being played in competitive EDH if you support such a thing, which I personally don't. But I'd also be ridiculous to imagine it doesn't happen anymore. Like, it's a reality. I don't think it's a negative thing. It's just something that I'm not personally interested in. But I think for especially the one-on-one lists, the French list and the MTG Salvation list both ban a lot of these cards, and that's definitely a step in the right direction for that.
I definitely agree. I think if you're going to play one-on-one EDH, then the artifact mana has definitely got to be the first thing to go. I think the best, the clearest way that I can think of to put it is that the artifact mana allows blue decks to play like green decks,
mm-hmm.
which is
horrible.
I mean, one of my friends and I were thinking about this as a little aside from EDH, but at least in the standard format, we can only come up with one standard season since standard has existed where blue was not the best color,
mm-hmm.
or one of the best colors. So allowing blue to basically do whatever they want is rather unbalancing. I think also, though, the artifact mana can lend itself to being metagamed against a little bit more, because there's so much excellent, excellent artifact hate that is very playable, very powerful, and also makes you play red, which is kind of fun, because red is probably the most underplayed color in EDH, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Just like being able to wreck people with cards like Meltdown and Rack and Ruin, just all these awesome, awesome cards that no one expects. I think the first time I played Hammer Mage against someone, they were just like, they didn't believe the card was real.
Oh no, Hammer Mage! You used Hammer Mage!
They literally just great. Read the card. They're like, no, that can't possibly be what that card actually does. Like, no, it is.
Yeah, it's that little fat guy standing there. He's kind of glowing. Right? Is that the card I'm thinking of?
Yep. The one whose spell shapes melt down.
That is outstanding. Good for you, Justin. I like that.
So, I mean, that's like the artifact mana can lend itself to being hated against, probably a little bit more so than green mana ramp can be, just because people tend to look down on land destruction a little bit more. Although I'm still totally down with Waker destructioning a forest, but I think people are generally less upset with you if you blow up someone's artifact ramp. Whereas if you go out of your way to destroy a bunch of someone's lands, even if they ramped into them, can oftentimes get some dirty looks around the table. So I think people understand overall the unbalancing aspect of artifact mana.
Just thinking that blue, you know, they it ramps green, it ramps. I'm just wondering, is there some sort of cutoff line, you know, where virtually any ramp spell under two mana, if you could just cut them off? And by ramp spell, I mean everything from a soul ring to a rampant growth. If you could cut off any two mana or under ramp spell, how would that change the format? What would that do to the fairness of some excessively powerful decks at the moment?
That's a very broad question with huge implications. I think, although, just to take a shot in the dark, I think that it would probably end up making the format look more like what people associate it with when it first started. I think there would be a lot more slower games, less racing towards combos, a lot less action in the early game, and a lot more inefficient stuff being used ultimately. That, or people would just revert to starting basically as though the game began on turn 3 and then start deploying their ramp, which is also totally feasible.
I mean, the biggest thing that occurs to me is, like, if you're really being strict in your interpretation of cutting off two mana or less, it really hurts most non-green decks' ability to color fix, because most of them are running Signets, which you wouldn't be allowed to play. So I think it would, like, you'd have to play more Paramorphic Expanse, Panorama, Fetchland type stuff, which would be good for you if you're playing Fetchlands and dual lands, and bad for you if you're not. So I could see it being particularly damaging to multicolor decks that aren't green. Man, that would cut out so many cards which are like...
staples.
Yeah, which are like ubiquitous in EDH.
Mm-hmm.
See so many Tribe Elders. That'd actually be a very interesting, an interesting tack to take. No, I don't even know. There's just lots of different things that you could try with that kind of format adjustment to it. There's a lot of things that change with that.
Okay, so finally, I guess, let's just, to sum things up, what do you guys think about these cards in general? Like, do you think they're good, bad, are you indifferent? Because personally, I think that this is the format where they should be allowed to stay, because we don't regulate it for balance. We regulate it for fun. Playing with these cards is fun, and if they are ruining somebody's fun, then I think it should be up to the local players to make a decision on what they want to do with them. If you play online, then I think you always have done that at your own risk. So that's not really... a realm that I'm interested in tweaking the ban list for. It's unfortunate you might have to deal with some things that you don't want to, and there's no way for you to avoid it. But when you're trying to play a primarily social game in an almost inherently anti-social medium, things might fall apart every now and then.
I think WotC have kind of condoned fast mana by printing Soul Ring in all the commander sets, but if it weren't for green, I would actually be inclined to cut Soul Ring and Mana Crypt and Mana Vault and the couple of monoliths, just because of the way that they force decks to run. I think that they naturally push decks into a high power strategy as opposed to a high fun strategy, and I think that does it hurt the format somewhat. But with green and its access to just get ahead of everyone so quickly, I don't think there's really much option.
Yeah, I think it's fine for the format. I think the biggest thing is that it definitely encourages players to play answers to powerful things that other people are doing. Because if you're just kind of focusing on your own thing and your opponent is focusing on their own better, more expensive thing, then you're clearly going to come up behind there. So it definitely encourages you to play more cards which answer what they're doing. Particularly because if you can answer the big expensive thing that they're doing, then they've spent a bunch of cards on
accelerant and you still have your stuff left. So I think it encourages that kind of play, and I think, I mean, as long as the green mana ramp is fine, then the artifact mana I think is fine too.
Okay, so that rounds out our free-for-all roundtable on fast mana. As always, each participant will sum their thoughts with a single word, and I'll go first with nostalgia. Neil?
I think unfortunate but necessary.
Three words, but I'll allow it. And then Justin?
I'd go with powerful.
Okay, good stuff. Very That's important. It for the free-for-all. Next, we're going to go into charity cases. We're going to be talking about the donations that people made to Gifts Given this week, and I have some really nice shout-outs to give as well. If you're interested in hearing more from that episode, again, that segment was from Season 4, Episode 6, Blue Braids Will Drink Your Tears is the title. Next up on the sampler, we have another community segment, but this one's a pretty substantial change of pace. Here at CommanderCast, we try to be informative and entertaining, and I certainly think this segment was one of our more entertaining ones that I can remember recently anyway. It's the first installment in a series that we ended up calling Doucheology, and in it, we examined various player types that could be corrosive or obnoxious at your playgroup, and we talked about how to identify them and maybe how to deal with them down the road to keep your playgroup healthy overall. And in this one, I had Benny Smith from StarCityGames.com.
Hey, how's it going, guys? My name's Benny Smith.
Cassidy Silver from TCGPlayer.com.
Hey, all. This is Cassidy.
And my usual CommanderCast co-host and co-administrator, Donovan, a.k.a. Dosu.
Hey, everybody. My name's Dosu. I also go by Donovan, I guess, in real life.
So this is a little bit more of a lighthearted segment, but I think you might find a little ring of truth to it as well, where we discuss various personality types, which we've titled The Salt Truck and Scoopy McGee.
For the second segment in the community segment, we're going to talk about Doucheology, which I believe is going to be a regular segment here on the show.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
So basically, the idea is there are some personalities that just, you know, tend to ruin a game of Commander, regardless of where they're sitting and basically what they're playing, even. This week, as I mentioned, we're starting the Doucheology series. We're going to discuss a taxonomy of the various douchebags we encounter in the wilderness of EDH. Now, how do we recognize them? Maybe sometimes we fall into these categories ourselves, which I know I do. And how can one reverse this behavior pattern, either in yourself or others? I guess what we're going to start with is Salt Truck, as I think Andy came up with this one.
Yes, this would be one that I'm quite familiar with as a salt truck that sometimes just veers out of control and spills the game, ruining everyone's experience.
So why don't you tell us about the Salt Truck then, Andy? That sounds good.
Yeah, sure. The Salt Truck is basically like the whiny bitch in your group. And I'm sure everyone has one of those, because God knows that I've been it more than once. The thing that characterizes the salt truck over the typical, like, garden variety whiny bitch, though, is they only become real salty when things just aren't going exactly their way. Sometimes it can feel justified. I know that's normally when I start to get into it. Like, let's say I'm playing a deck that's maybe not even that good, and get all the removal seems to be pointed at my stuff. I can't get anything to stick on the board. I'm not gonna lie, sometimes I get a little miserable despite myself when those kind of things happen. It's frustrating. It feels like you can't influence a game at all and everyone is conspiring to get you. And that's the salt truck mindset that leads to, you know, spilling salt all over the place and just getting super sour. And normally the things that characterize somebody that's in like salt truck mode is they're very like pouty. Like they sit there and there's a lot of like, oh, well, I can't do anything. And they'll say, like, really passive-aggressive things like, oh, well, you must be just swimming in removal there if you're going to point that at my thing. You know, like, a lot of criticizing other people's plays despite the fact that you're having no impact on the game at all. You should probably just shut the fuck up and take your licks. But, yeah, the Salt Truck's real corrosive. Ooh! Awesome! Yeah, he's a very corrosive personality to have at the table because it's so easy to make things feel, like, awkward. By just a couple of remarks, especially if everyone else is like just kind of trying to enjoy themselves, then every time you know you draw a card, you look at it and you slap your hand back down the table and you're like, well, I can't do anything. Take your turn. It's just really unpleasant to deal with. Or in my case, and I have no problem with admitting this, being this guy sometimes it sucks. What leads you into it is like this downward spiral of negativity. Like you're not able to do anything, which frustrates you, so you get vocal about it, and then you get like more and more negative. And a lot of times I think people start to destroy your stuff out of spite because you're being a dick. And then, yeah, obviously that's not going to improve the situation. So maybe I just have, like, really spiteful friends like the aforementioned Tony Stark. But I don't think that's it. I think most of the time this comes from your own kind of EDH heart of darkness here. and you just transform yourself into this overwhelming vortex of negativity that risks sucking the whole game down there with you.
Oh, okay, I gotcha. I'd usually just... I usually like to egg those kind of people on. You know,
yeah, so you're that asshole I'm talking to. Yeah, it provokes this guy.
It won't even take like a bunch of it. As soon as you start whining a little bit, you just gotta go. Like you said, it'll bring down the whole game, and I don't like dealing with whiners at all. So that sounds like exactly someone I would not like.
And the other thing is too, it's not just generic whining like, oh, that card's overpowered, or oh, that's stupid, or why isn't that banned? Like that's. I think that's more just being a Magic player, that kind of whining, right? It's always like really specifically related to the game and the situation they're in, and a lot of the time it springs from that kind of, like I was describing earlier, the feeling of helplessness. Like, in Magic, the whole goal is to interact with your opponents, not necessarily through conventional means like destroying their permanents, but maybe by depleting their life total with a super cool interactive storm combo or something. But you want to do something, and if it just feels like you can't get anything going, it makes you feel so shitty.
I think I'm in the same boat as Andy on this one. Like, I catch myself doing this sometimes, and I try really hard to not get, like, too emotionally attached to just, like, a game of Magic.
Yeah, like, but, Donovan is a better man than me, so this surprises me. I wouldn't go
that far, but I have noticed that I tend to be more sensitive, like, if I just build a new deck and I want to try it out and I want to see it work. Like, just once, I want to see it work. And my old playgroup was pretty cutthroat, and I'm cool with that because we're all pretty thick-skinned around here. But for example, like the first game we play, Grand Arbiter player gets turn one Soul Ring into Grand Arbiter, and then clones it on the next turn, and then Sakashima's it the turn after that. I'm like, oh my god! And he just like crushes that game, and I don't do much of anything. And then the next game, the Sisay player just like ramps out of control, and then like Armageddons everybody, and he's got like a ton of fatties out. And I was just getting kind of annoyed that, you know, I can't just see my new deck do what it's supposed to do, and instead I just keep getting all my lands blown up effectively. But at the same time, just got to chill out and remember it's a game, because I really don't want to be the salt truck in the future. It's zero fun for anybody.
Yeah, I had to laugh with it. Like, I wasn't even thinking of salt, like the salt that you'd spread for ice and stuff. I was just thinking of, like, endless tears that have dried.
I think that's a perfectly legitimate way to put it, you know?
But I had to admit that I've been the salt truck on occasion myself, too. And it's like you said, especially like, you know, when Donovan was mentioning you lovingly spend a bunch of time to build your deck, you just wanted something to come together. You know, one or two of the combos that you've put in there, some cool plays. And, you know, you sit down and your opponents are all playing some kind of crazy combo and they're just annihilating you and you've got nothing going on. And I sometimes succumb to the salt truck and start getting really irritated.
I think there's a jealousy factor, too. You see everyone else doing cool things.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there like, well, I guess I'll play this land that I managed to draw. Winner! You know, it's not a great feeling. Now, before we get on to our second douchebag of the week here, I kind of want to talk about how you, like, we've gone over the symptoms of being the salt truck, what leads to it. Now, how would you guys reverse it? Now, I think Cassidy's option of just boot fucking them into the ground, probably not the best socially, unless you have a really good group of friends. But
they'll learn eventually.
Exactly. It is a legitimate solution, especially if they're really caustic to the game environment. At that point, maybe you should, you know, just remove them from the situation, you know?
Exactly.
This way they can no longer influence everybody in a negative manner. It might produce harsh feelings, but usually I also find another thing with the salt truck is it's very short term, like it's reversible. I think once you move beyond being like the, you know, one game salt truck into this carrying over, you've stopped kind of being an EDH, like, douche-ology douchebag, and you're more just an asshole all the time, probably. You're probably just a bitter, petty person that no one really likes. So,
wow. I like these wild generalizations.
This is real talk here, but yeah, you know, so I think usually the salt truck thing is reversible, so I think just eliminating someone from the game is an easy way to resolve it, because when that game's over, they're going to come back in the next game, they'll have like that strengthened resolve, you know, they'll be on their Rocky 2, as it were, and ready to come back into this game with renewed vigor. Come back and play a more interactive game where they have more influence.
Why not look at it a different way, too? Like, maybe this makes group hug decks actually something worthwhile. you know, just bring a group hug deck to big games so that when someone starts getting too salt trucky, you just start giving them cards or letting them draw cards so that they'll shut up. Maybe group hug is actually useful. So.
Like actually overtly assisting the salt.
Yeah. Yeah.
To keep them from spraying more salt. Yes, that's certainly a valid option as well, because if they can't get something going like by you kind of greasing the wheels there for them, you know, right, I think exactly. Even the worst players like me have to realize their deck's just not good.
I was thinking maybe another option too would be talk about what could have happened to you when, you know, you've stuck curb stomp salt truck into the ground and the game is over and they're very sad and whiny about the situation. You might say, well, thank God you didn't have card X to put a stop to that, so that you can kind of passive-aggressively suggest them improving their deck a little bit, you know?
that's good.
Actually, that's funny, too, because, like, the post-game I would have won if guy is, like, a whole other douchebag, you know? But maybe you can make him feel like he could have won, you know?
Not even, like, you could have won if guy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that, like, lift his spirits up so he feels better before the next game. Like, well, you know, we had to get you because, you know, if we didn't, you just would have killed us, you know?
It's a good thing your deck sucked or you might have beat me.
All right, and with that, we're going to move on to our next case of doucheology, which is Scoopy McGee. So we'll let Cassie lead this one up because this is somebody apparently he's very familiar with.
Yeah, I have one of my friends that I play a lot of EDH with that likes to scoop, and it's not even that like the board state isn't favorable and you know you're gonna lose so you scoop, which is fine with me. It's more like, oh, I just drew my eighth land and I don't feel like playing anymore, so he scooped and I turned seven. It was really weird. So also he's the same guy who scooped in a match for no real reason. I don't know why he did. And then he decided to unscoop and attack a different player. It's kind of weird. Like, he packed up the deck, and then he's like, oh, wait, I could attack you instead. Okay, hold on. Let me get set up again so I could send some troops your way. I have no problem with people that scoop when, you know, you're going to lose just so you can start another game. That sounds good. But the random scooping for no reason is pretty irksome. And Not, you know, it's just not fun to play against, honestly, so.
Yeah, the worst thing about Scoopy McGee is that unlike the Salt Truck, whose disruption is mostly, like, social, having a guy scoop prematurely or seemingly for no reason or when they don't want to explain why or just out of spite actually disrupts the mechanical flow of the game. Like, the actual game itself is heavily influenced by a single-player exiting because if you could think of it, all resources that have been sent towards that player disrupting them and hurting them were effectively wasted. Because they've just elected voluntarily to take themselves out of the game. So you need a kind of a cumulative effort to remove a player. And then when they voluntarily take themselves out as an elective, you've nullified all that effort that people have put into that game. And it just cheapens the whole feel of the game as well. It's not the same as the douche scoop, which is another segment I'm sure we'll run again in the future. But we kind of have our own lexicon here now. Like the tactical concession guy is kind of another story because that's generally, you know, pretty much strictly out of spite. But they usually do it when they're close to losing or are about to lose anyway.
Right, right.
Whereas this guy, Scoopy McGee, just like, it seems like you could roll dice to determine when he scoops. You know? Like just, oh shit, scoop time! You know? Like pulls his cell phone out, oh snap, got a scoop! You know? And then, like you were saying, yeah, you know what I'm talking about. The worst of all, though, is definitely like the unscoop. Like, oh well, maybe I was still in it, you know? And then they gotta go through all their stuff and it's like, oh, I think you shuffled your graveyard in, oh, which ones are in your hand? And then you have to wait, like, forever for this herp derp to figure out what he had and what he didn't have. Oh, my God. It is the worst. So just don't be this guy. This is a bad one to be. And on the plus side, this is an easy species of douchebag to spot in the wild. And it's an easy one to know that to kind of self-diagnose because it's obvious. How many games do you scoop in? When was the last time you conceded? Why did you do it? Did everyone say, why are you giving up? If so, you're probably one of these guys.
I've noticed one of the things that might prompt Scoopy McGee to scoop is when he or she loses like a huge rules argument. And they're just like, well, if you're playing that way, I don't want to play anymore. They kind of take
really?
Their ball and go home. I've seen this on several occasions.
Is this like an online thing or in the real?
Yes.
Like, oh!
I mean, you know, some of the rules arguments that make you scratch your head and it's just like, how can I argue with this person because what they're claiming is so out of left field? And
They're just I'll see if I can give you an example. Reality than you are.
Like, okay, I was playing a Chimeric Idol. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
Okay. You know, you have to tap all, it says tap all lands you control, turn into a 3-3 till end of turn. And so I go to do that, and then someone says, wait, like all your lands are already tapped, you can't activate that. And I'm like, what? And like most of the table agreed that I had to have at least one land untapped to activate my Chimeric Idol. And,
oh no.
And you, no one scooped. I don't know. Like, how do I argue about
like space?
That? I was outnumbered. But in any case, like, no one scooped in that particular scenario, but that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. If we argue for like 5 minutes and then they lose the argument, they're just like, oh, whatever. Peace out, dog.
Just like that. And they gone. Yes. They bounce.
I have to say that luckily I don't have too many Scooby McGee's that I've run across. But I think, you know, it's just mostly sounds like you just got to get a hold of your emotions. You know, you got to not let yourself get invested in any particular way that the game's going or a particular game. You know, you just got to step outside, get some fresh air, you know, go get you a soda, take a little break.
Yeah.
You know, don't just scoop up your cards. I mean, we all get, you know, everyone's got a temper and can lose it, you know, for other factors. You just got to, you know, realize that you're there to have some fun.
I think it's kind of the same solution I had for the salt truck. I just kind of poked fun at it. You know, that's where Scoopy McGee came from. You know, I named him that, and then I called him that. And he kind of got over it, you know, after I just kept making fun of him. And he doesn't really Scoopy McGee anymore, but it certainly was, it was outrageous for a little while how many scoops he would have. And that's, I guess it's kind of the tactic I learned from Red Foreman from some 70s show.
Yeah, just badger them until they change their ways.
Exactly. The Red Foreman method, that's pretty much how I deal with those guys.
All right, so that was our first segment on Doucheology. This segment has been brought to you by Morton's Iodized Salt. When it rains, it pours. So that's it for Community this week. Next, we're going to move into the strategy segment. We're going to be doing an archetype rundown on Voltron.
If you'd like to hear more from that particular episode, then you can always head over to CommanderCast.com and look up Season 4, Episode 5, Scooby McGee and the Salt Truck. And that concludes the community segments for the sample episode. So after community, we always transition into strategy, where we start talking about actual gameplay and how you can kind of elevate your game. Oftentimes, we also talk about how to play particular strategies or deck styles, how to play against certain hated archetypes, all that kind of stuff that can hopefully make you a better player in the end. And co-hosting this segment with me, I have Byron, who is the first Commander Cast co-host, all the way back to episode 1.
Hey there, guys. My name is Byron.
Carlos, author of The Arcane Lab over at QuietSpeculation.com.
I'm Carlos.
And Donovan once again.
Hi, I'm Donovan.
This strategy segment is from Season 3, Episode 1, the season premiere, and in it, we're going to be talking about how oftentimes players seem to think that games start around Turn 5 with very high mana curves and uneven development before that, and how you can leverage that to your advantage.
Alright, so in today's strategy segment, we're going to be talking about the myth that EDH games start on turn 5. This is something that I see in a lot of different groups to varying degrees. There are a lot of groups that don't feel like any card that is not Sol Ring or Kadama's Reach should be cast before at least turn 5. And so what we want to talk about is, like, what are you doing before turn 5? What are you doing after turn 5? What are you setting up for? And what kinds of decks either play into this or take advantage of it? So, like, we've all played those games where someone plays, like, a turn 1 Sol Ring and then runs away with the early game because they got to turn 5 first. Personally, I'm not a huge fan of the idea that the only thing you should be doing before the mid-game is playing ramp spells. I like doing things that are proactive. I like punishing people who are playing those mid-rangey and really late-game kinds of decks just because you see so many of them. Like, Zozu the Punisher is someone that I keep coming back to because everyone's playing Kodama's Reach and Explosive Vegetations, and, like, you get a billion free damage off of that. So I guess I don't feel like that's necessarily true, that games don't start until turn 5 or turn 6, and I don't think it should be true.
Another thing, too, is turn 5 is just kind of an expression. You know, like, I'm not saying turn 5 is a hard, concrete thing, like, just that games start, like Carlos said, we have an early game, we have a mid game, and then we have a late game. A lot of people like to wait till the mid game to start playing spells that aren't ramp or like really early setup type cards. And then they like the late game to go on forever, where games are just kind of, decks are spinning their wheels, they're generating quote unquote value, but the value isn't really going towards anything a lot of the time. And in the early phase, like I love the early phase of the game because they're interesting and they're dynamic and a lot of things can happen if you choose to make them happen. The problem is that people get angry if you do it too much. Like if you just drop fast and efficient creatures, people say, okay, aggro is bad in EDH, blah, 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 blah. But if people aren't playing anything in the early turns, you can play really disruptive, powerful early turn plays like Viridian Corruptor that can have a huge splash, and they can kind of not really run away with a multiplayer game, but they can leave one person in a position so thoroughly compromised, it's crazy. Now, whether you think that's fun or not is the other side of this issue. Like, your group should agree on a comfortable pace. You know, like you should decide, okay, well, everyone knows what I'm talking about, where you get a feel for the other people's decks and you see, okay, what phase of the game we're moving into here and there. If you're wildly divergent from that, it can be really unpleasant for other people. So that's another issue that kind of comes up with this pace of game issue.
I definitely have to agree with Andy here. Like, there's a difference between using the early game to set the tone of a game and just making it so that no one else can play. Like, there's a difference between casting, I keep coming back to Zozu the Punisher. There's a difference between casting him on turn two and flipping Irayo on turn two. Like, there's a pretty clear distinction between those things as far as I'm concerned, where one sets the tone of the game and says that it's going to be a quick game, there's going to be a lot of pressure, and you're going to have to stabilize. And the other is, you're going to sit here for the next 2.5 hours watching me play Magic.
I love the early turns where you're applying pressure and stuff like that. Like, to me, the late game actually tends to be less interesting. Like, yeah, it's cool that your deck can do all these things, but how does your deck do under pressure? Or how does your deck actually create pressure? Like, I don't know. The early turns just seem more dynamic to me. There's more going on if you're prepared for them. The games tend to be a little bit faster and decisive, and I like that. So that's just a personal style thing.
Yeah, I actually think Wizards is encouraging decks that pressure other decks early, just in the new product that they've been releasing. Like, one of the new generals that got recently spoiled for the Commander product. These are a bit of spoilers, so if you guys out there don't want to hear about spoilers, you guys probably don't want to listen to this right now. There is a new commander out there that got released called Skullbriar the Walking Grave. It costs 1 black and 1 green, so it's a 2-mana black-green general, and it's a 1/1 with haste. And whenever it deals combat damage to a player, you get to put a +1/+1 counter on it. And the cool thing about it says, counters remain on Skullbriar as it moves to any zone other than a player's hand or library. So even if it dies and goes back to the command zone, it's still going to keep all those +1/+1 counters. And the thing about it is that costs only 2 mana, so you can immediately play this on turn 2 if you have the mana ready and immediately attack someone and instantly apply pressure in the form of general damage, no doubt. So if someone tries to kill Skullbriar, well, that's okay. I mean, you're probably going to have 4 lands by the time you recast them again, you can start attacking again. But just the fact that Wizards is printing a commander like this that is this aggressive shows that they do encourage decks to not just do nothing for 5 turns and then start actually playing the game. Like, they are encouraging, like, people that do want to do this, that do want to apply pressure in the early game, to actually have those kinds of avenues.
Right. I definitely I agree with what you just pointed out, Byron. Another one of the commanders that got spoiled is called Edric, Spymaster of Trest. This costs 1 green and a blue for a 2/2, and it says, whenever a creature deals combat damage to one of your opponents, that creature's controller may draw a card. So, I mean, this guy comes down fast, and it encourages a lot of the swinging back and forth at the multiplayer table in the early turns. And if you wait till the late turns, like turn 5 or later, then oftentimes people have their mana bases set up and they'll have blockers. So if you're playing with this guy, you know, you're going to have to start interacting before turn 5 unless you just want to get, like, swamped in card disadvantage.
Yeah, that's interesting too, because if you play one of these decks, like, either, you know, maybe they just won't work that well. We don't know. None of us have played with it, I'm assuming, at this point. No one's playing with the spoiled cards, right?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
So we don't know how those are going to work out. They might encourage a little bit more aggression. They might be total flops. They might be completely awesome. We don't know. But an important thing to keep in mind is that, like, even if your group isn't necessarily comfortable with a faster pace, like a more pressure-filled environment, you know, you should respect their wishes. But by the same token, don't be afraid to be the guy that shakes things up every now and then and comes in there
and rattles the table a little bit before turn four with some fast, strong creatures, you know, like putting an Imperial Plate on a guy with poison or something like that and thinking, oh, people have to think, you know, oh shit, maybe my mana curve should have started below four, you know, because now I'm dead. And it sucks to kill someone super early and then a game devolves into a longer grindy state. But as people start thinking, okay, I have to prepare defenses now in the early game, I have to keep a lower curve. If everyone, you develop a sort of downwards arms race into the mana curve, and then everyone's playing these faster decks. So the games kind of equate, like, you can warp your metagame using this. Warp has negative connotations, but you can change your metagame. And if those are the kind of games you want to play, there's a variety of decks that can enable you to do that, to shift things more in a direction that you want.
Yeah. The point I'm trying to make overall is that if Wizards is encouraging us to have these generals that you can apply early pressure with, I'd say it's a good thing, because I know some people out there like the quote-unquote battlecruiser-style magic, but I think the people that do want to do stuff like early on in the game shouldn't be left in the dark either. So it is good to see Wizards giving us some new commanders that allow us to do stuff in the early game.
I know we've talked in the past about how running spot removal isn't as bad as everyone thinks. Do you think that mentality, you know, running a bunch of high mana cost sweepers instead of low mana cost spot removal, like, ties into this whole thing? Like, if people ran more spot removal, would it be okay to interact before turn five?
I think it would be more socially acceptable. But I think a lot of the part of the reason that people aren't running the spot removal is that people aren't playing serious fast threats, right? So at that point, they're not as necessary, so the conventional wisdom becomes they're bad, because you can only comment on what you know, right? Like, if your metagame is full of 6+ casting cost creatures that come out, you know, after turn 5, 6, 7, whatever, then yeah, sorcery speed sweepers are probably going to be better because you're going to get more value out of them. But if you have to kill a given creature right now, then yeah, you know, terror suddenly starts looking a lot more appealing. So it's all about metagame perception.
I definitely have to agree. Like, the thing that people keep getting, you get told as soon as you enter the format that aggro doesn't exist, it's not viable, because you have to deal 120 points of damage instead of 20. And just because traditional aggro, in the sense that you're going to play a Jackal Pup and then a Keldon Marauder or whatever and curve out like that, just because that doesn't exist doesn't mean there aren't aggressive strategies that apply pressure in the early game. They look very different, but they still do exist, and I don't feel like it's reasonable to shut those out just because of social stigma and because we don't want to change our decks because we assumed that those things didn't exist.
See, I would kind of actually disagree there. Like, if what most people want to play is Battlecruiser Magic or the slower kind of grindier games, the most EDH games become, if that's what your group is comfortable with, there's no reason to change. Right?
Oh, I definitely agree. Like, if that's what you want to play,
yeah,
that's perfectly fine. What I'm saying is that people just assume that aggro doesn't exist because of this, you have to deal 120 points of damage. Mm-hmm, it's not that they do or don't want to play against it. They just assume that it doesn't exist, which isn't true.
I would encourage you to try it, actually. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, it's awesome. And plus, you get to play land destruction as disruption. So, you know, win-win. But the other thing is, if that's the kind of wisdom that you want to follow and you want to play these slower games, why not be the one guy that comes in with the fast deck that puts the pressure on? Because games are boring when all the games play the same way and all the decks roughly follow the same tempo and archetype. Like, one of the key elements of diversity in a healthy metagame is different tempo. Like, different decks should play at different speeds, and maybe your game is good at hurting people during the development, and then you have to have cards that have reach in Commander. Like, that's a given. You know, you can't expect to win with small creature beatdown. Small creatures can be good in the early game and hurt people, but you need to be able to finish them off later. So you have to keep that in mind as well. You know, but the other thing with playing these fast cards you have to keep in mind is it's dangerous sometimes, because people can be overreact. Like, oh snap, you know, he played a troll ascetic really early and put some serious buffs on it, and now it's killing someone. That can turn a whole table against you, because they perceive you as the threat, because instead of playing a bunch of engines that will let someone win the game if they remain on the table, they're worried about that troll ascetic that will kill someone in a couple of turns, and it will only kill one person instead of letting the one guy eventually win the game. So people's threat assessment can be a little bit wonky against these decks. You can feel like you have a giant target pain on your back. People learn, though. Don't worry about that. If you lose games, you lose games, whatever. But if this is a kind of deck you want to play, don't feel discouraged by that. People will learn eventually that, okay, you know what, maybe maybe we're overreacting to these things we're destroying. But you have to be aware of that as well.
Yeah, see, I like the idea of questioning the norm. And, you know, like Carlos said, some people just assume that these kinds of decks don't exist. And when you show up at a table that isn't used to this sort of thing, and you just, like, power out, oh, here's a turn one Saracen, and here's turn two other problematic
Stoneforge Mystic. Yes.
Yeah, there you go. Like, I mean, that makes people reevaluate their deck building. And, I don't know, I greatly appreciate that. It keeps the metagames from becoming stagnant. And while it might not be the most fun thing to play against when you're not equipped to,
It's fun to adapt to it.
Yeah, I agree. That's what I'm shooting for.
Now, the other thing I wanted to talk about here with these fast decks, where you're playing games early, is how, like, are we including combo in this? Because people consider setting up combo pieces early offensive almost, you know, universally, unless that's a common feature of a metagame. That makes a lot of people really salty. Like, do you guys think that that's the, do you guys agree that that's the same thing? Because I think if you put it into your deck, then you play it, right? That only makes sense to me. It doesn't make sense to think, I better hold on to my combo pieces, even though I know people can't deal with them because people will get upset. Like, you make the conscious decision to put it in the deck in the deck construction phase. So, you know, use it. But I don't know. Is this kind? Do you guys think that's kind of the same thing? Or at that point, is that somehow different and degenerate? Like, what are your perspectives?
So the thing about combo is that there's two kinds. There's interactive combos and non-interactive combos. Like the Hermit Druid deck that runs Infinite Disruption and tries to win the game by turn three or turn four is non-interactive. And that's usually incredibly offensive to most people because it's totally against what people perceive as the spirit of the format. Because you're trying to prevent people from interacting with you at all and ending the game before anyone else has done anything. There are other combo decks that try to set up early but encourage interaction, like rely on other people to have pieces of their combo in play or whatever. And those can be really interesting and they add a sort of tension to the game where you have to always keep an eye on the combo player and make sure they're not going to assemble their extra pieces or whatever. Like, to me, it depends on how interactive you're being. If you sit down with the intention of making it so that no one else gets to interact with you and no one else gets to play, then that's not really what I'm looking for in a game, personally. But if you're looking to play a combo that I can interact with and prevent you from playing if I have a good curve and removal and disruption, then that's totally acceptable. And if you win, then you win and we can shuffle up and play again. No foul.
Well, just for the sake of argument, like, would you say it's okay to like drop a couple huge creatures on the first early turns and then, you know, I know Andy likes land destruction, like just Armageddon away all the lands and keep people from interacting with you that way?
Well, I mean, it depends. Is that the point of your deck? Like, I don't like playing against the decks that are just Joyra, a bunch of giant creatures, and a bunch of obliterates, because they do the same thing every time, and the point is drop some guys and then prevent people from interacting with you.
So,
like, that's not interesting to me, but I'm not opposed to it on principle.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, like, the vibe I'm getting from this, like, it's okay to interact before turn five as long as it's not, like, too much, like a game-ending stage three play before everyone else is set up. Is that the common sentiment?
See, yeah, that's kind of where I'm trying to see where people put the line here, because personally, like, my whole thing is if you put it into the deck, then use it, right? Like, you have to make these decisions before the game starts on how you're going to play it. Your deck construction should reflect how you intend to play. It shouldn't really be the other way around. So if you know that that's a little bit much for the comfort level of a group, then you probably just shouldn't build that deck in the first place. Like I'm saying, this is one of those really nebulous things. Like, what kind of pressure is okay, what isn't? It's so dependent on, like, local variation. And, you know, I think it's kind of hard to come up with a hard and fast answer for that one. Like, that's one of the more ambiguous things. This is not something that can really be answered black and white. But personally, at least once, sure, anything goes. Try it once, you know. Tried a couple of times, but if everyone gets really grumpy and groany about it, then yeah, okay, you know, let's switch things up a little bit here.
It also has to depend mainly on, like, the type of threat that gets played early on. Like, for example, with a Saracen that gets played early, it's one of those things that people are like, oh man, I can't believe he had that turn one, and, you know, like, he's going to start hitting people with it, and someone's going to be taking damage pretty early on. But it is one of those things that you can, you know, take a few hits, and you know, you still have at least a few turns until you finally get to having to actually have to deal with Saracena before it becomes a problem. Now, that's different in the case of something like Hermadruid, because Hermadruid basically issues an ultimatum to everyone saying, if you do not kill me before I untap, the game's over. I mean, it is like the absolute most urgent thing that you have to stop. Whereas with a thing like Sir Ascendant, you can at least, it's early pressure, but you still have some leeway and some, at least like a cushion of a few turns to deal with it before it actually becomes a problem. So it's mainly a difference in the urgency of having to deal with a threat that gets played early on.
Okay, yeah, so what are your guys' kind of summary, final thoughts on this whole notion of games, you know, slow starts to games, early pressure, that kind of thing? Because personally, I think it's cool. If it shakes up your local metagame, you might as well try it and see how people react to it. But if the reaction's really negative, well, then you know, why would you continue doing it? Like, if you're just griefing everyone, then yeah, maybe put the brakes on that. But it's a fun change of pace.
Yeah, that's pretty much where I stand. Like, I think it's okay to do early plays. I even think it's okay to try to combo out early. But, you know, if everyone is 100% against it, then, you know, be a nice guy. Put the deck away for a little while.
All right. So that's it for this strategy segment, which kind of turned into a false idol segment. But whatever. So, yeah, you know, your thoughts on, like, that's a big thing, too. What's an acceptable early play that creates pressure? Like, is combo creating their pressure okay? Aggro, is that cool? Like, is early land destruction okay? You know, it's so nebulous, it's kind of interesting to see how different people feel about that. So be sure to send in any feedback that you have on that, because I'd like to get some different opinions. But beyond that, next we're going to move into the return of Hated Out. We're going to be talking about the usual suspects. And if you'd like to hear the rest of that particular podcast, it was Season 3, Episode 1, the season premiere, available at CommanderCast.com. And now, after the strategy segment, we tend to move things into the technology segment. So these segments tend to be us discussing individual cards. We often read what the cards do aloud in the Oracle wording, just so that the listeners know exactly what's going on with them. A lot of time we're sharing the secret cards that a lot of people aren't playing in their decks seem a little bit more obscure and could maybe use some more play. Other times we're doing things like product reviews for sets or standalone releases like the Commander expansion that came out in the summer of 2011. But this is something that we call an entourage segment, and in it, we take a legendary creature that was suggested by a listener, and oftentimes they're a little bit off the beaten path, and then we build a deck skeleton around that commander, usually one that specifically abuses their unique abilities. This technology segment is from Season 2, Episode 6, and this was our first and by far the most popular entourage segment that we've ever done, and it was for Ib Halfheart, Goblin Tactician. Now, helping me form this entourage, I had Adam.
Hey, I'm Adam, also known as Fugu.
Carlos.
Hi, I'm Carlos.
And Jeremiah with me.
My name is Jeremiah, Chives McShivers on the official forum.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening in now to the birth of the Ib Nation. So this week in technology, we're doing a new ongoing segment, which was actually created by listeners. It's going to be called Entourages. And in it, we take an underplayed commander that is suggested by listeners, and then we kind of provide a skeleton of a couple of cards that could form the foundation of a deck to build around them. Now, these generals are going to be a little bit off the beaten path. We're not going to do, oh yeah, you know what's really good with Niv-Mizzet? Curiosity, herp derp. You know, we're going to stay away from that. Instead, we're going to focus on guys that don't see much play, and we might even throw in a couple cards you don't see all that often that synergize with them nicely. That said, especially this first guy we're doing, listener suggested by Levi, this guy is not going to be the bomb. You're not going to see, you know, people saying, oh my god, my top tier Ib Halfheart Goblin Tactician deck. It's probably just not going to happen, but it could be fun to build around. That's why we're focusing on it. So like I kind of led into there, the general this week is Ib Halfheart Goblin Tactician. And he was a Goblin Advisor. He costs 3 and a red. He's a 3/2.
It says whenever a goblin you control becomes blocked, Sacrifice it. If you do, it deals 4 damage to each creature blocking it. It has one other ability. Sacrifice 2 mountains. Put 2 1/1 red goblin creature tokens onto the battlefield.
All right. So obviously we want to be, you know, using both those abilities. That's the other thing with this segment. We're not looking to build good stuff decks with these guys at the head. We really want to kind of build around them. So we each have selected 2 cards that we're going to suggest. My picks are going to be Invasion Plans and Repercussion. So Invasion Plans was an enchantment that was printed in Stronghold. It costs 2 red and, sorry, 2 colorless and a red. And all creatures block each turn if able. The attacking player chooses how each creature blocks each turn. So this kind of lets you manipulate sacrificing these goblins to produce damage to the fullest. If people don't have blockers, that's great. You're going to go through and damage them. if they did have blockers, then this is probably the only chance a lot of these 1-1 goblins were going to have to hurt them in the first place. So by letting you manipulate the blocks, you'll let your important goblins, like your goblin pile driver, go through, and you'll be able to let the crappy ones not.
And probably let Ibhafart go through as well.
Yeah, because we don't want him to expire. Yeah. So actually,
general damage.
Yeah, with this on the board, you never know. You could general damage someone to death with your 3-2, which would be pretty ballin', I guess. Now, invasion plan synergizes really nicely with the next card I'm going to suggest, which is Repercussion. Now, Repercussion was printed in Urza's Destiny. It was a rare enchantment. It's 1 colorless and 2 red. Whenever a creature is dealt damage, Repercussion deals that much damage to that creature's controller. So, you have invasion plans on the board, and you have a bunch of crappy 1-1 goblins. You ship them all in at your opponent's token deck or whatever. And then, when you force all these blocks, and you sacrifice all these dudes, all of a sudden he's taking 4 damage for every little crappy goblin that you sacrifice, in addition to probably deleting a good deal of his creatures. So I think that's probably going to be a pretty good trade. Repercussion is also just awesome on its own. You'll get all kinds of damage out of it. Now, it can be risky for you, because you're probably going to have a lot of creatures in play. And if someone comes along and drops their The Dark Inferno, it's going to hurt. But hopefully you have a sacrifice outlet in play at that point. If not, well, you're playing Ib Halfheart, so whatever. Make the best of it.
Luckily. So we're
going to move on to Adam here, who's going to be able to shore up some of those weaknesses.
Luckily, one of my cards is a sac outlet. The card is Shivan Harvest. It's a 2-mana enchantment. It costs red 1. And it has 1 activated ability. Red 1, sacrifice a creature, destroy target non-basic land. This card is serious business. It's going to be like you're going to win games with it. You're going to lock people out of the game with it. If that's not what you want to do, this is not the card for you. But you are, as we've said before, this will be our excuse for the whole segment, is that you're playing Ib Halfheart, Goblin Tactician. So you deserve a little bit of tier 1 somewhere in your deck.
You deserve some goodness, I would say, for
so,
sure.
You know, if you get to the point where you just want to, you killed all the guys that have basic lands, you could just, sack a bunch of mountains, and then you get all this fodder to lock somebody else out of their mana base. That's you're just going to win games that way. The other card I want to suggest is also an enchantment. It's called Mana Echoes. It costs red, red 2. Whenever a creature enters the battlefield, you may add X to your mana pool, where X is the number of creatures you control that share a creature type with it. This would be pretty degenerate in the right scenario combined with the right other cards and Ib Halfheart. You're gonna, the first time you activate the ability of Ib Halfheart, you're gonna get 2 mana, 1 for each goblin. When you sacrifice 2 more mountains, then each of those 2 goblins is gonna make 3 mana, so you're gonna get 6 plus 2 is 8, and then it's just gonna be. It's gonna grow
geometrically pretty wildly. Yeah.
So, if you tap all those mountains for red on the way out, and so I'm sure you'll have enough red mana to do whatever it is you want to do, whether it's Comet Storm the table, or I don't know, activate Shivan Harvest a bunch of times. There's going to be something productive to do with your mana. It shouldn't be very difficult.
Okay. The 2 cards I chose. The first one is going to be pretty apparent. Vicious Shadows. Whenever a creature is put into the graveyard from play, you may have Vicious Shadows deal damage to target player equal to the number of cards in that player's hand. I'm assuming if you're playing Ib, you're going to have some sort of sac outlet. We talked about a few before, things like Skull Clamp are going to be out there too. So, also, people are going to block your goblins. So, sacking the goblins is going to start to deal just a lot of damage. The second one is going to be a little bit more fun. Confusion in the Ranks. This is a 3-colorless, 2-red enchantment. Whenever an artifact, creature, or enchantment comes into play, its controller chooses target permanent another player controls that shares a type with it. Exchange control of those permanents. So basically, you get to turn your little goblins into Blightsteel Colossus or things like that.
Kozilek, Windcoil Engines.
Yeah, I mean, there's a million good trade. Creatures out there that pretty much are all better than a 1-1 goblin. So, I think this card is probably pretty cool, with the Ib Halfheart. You should be able to just put out creatures on demand a little bit faster than anybody else. I think you can probably do some pretty cool things with it. So
it's just a really great way to kind of embrace the chaos of EDH, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a way to put it. So, yeah. You know, I don't think it is ever going to be awesome, but you can go the Gnar and the Wary way and play Confusion in the ranks.
One thing I just want to suggest, too, with the Vicious Shadows is, like, every now and then you'll have someone have a Herp Derp moment, and they'll cast a Wrath while you have Ib, and you have a bunch of mountains. And you just sacrifice all the mountains and kill everyone.
Seems good. A lot of people
just, yeah, they're just not going to think of that. And that is completely viable. If you unfortunately end up in the late game playing your Ib half-heart deck, and you're not going to be at an advantage at that point, do not be afraid to kill everyone by doing that. On the other hand, if someone instant disenchants it, it's going to suck. But once things kind of got beyond like the turn 10 mark, you probably weren't going to win anyway. So just go all in.
I think that's what you have to
with this deck. Yeah, just go all in all the time.
Except turn 4. Don't go all in on turn 4.
Oh, never win on turn 4. Never win on turn 4.
Ib half heart, sack my lands. I got 4 goblins. Yes.
Swish, I'm rich. No, just never win on turn 4. If anything I've learned from reading internet forums, it's that turn 4 is the cutoff for some reason, too. Okay, that aside, Carlos, go ahead.
All right. So, with this first card, I'm going to suggest I'm pretty sure we just broke the format. Promise Celebration. Yes. Furnace Celebration is an uncommon from Scars of Mirrodin. Costs 1 double red. It's an enchantment, and whenever you sacrifice a permanent, you can pay 2 to deal 2 damage to a creature or player. So with Mana Echoes, you sack all your lands, make 1,000,000 mana. You have a sack out, like, say, Skirk Prospector, Skull Clamp, something like that.
You just sacrificed all your mountains. Those are permanents.
Yeah. Yep.
And you made a bunch of goblins. You just made a bunch of mana.
Oh, you know what? I think I just had a Herp Derp because the trigger goes on the stack and the Goblin Half-Heart trigger, the Furnace Celebration trigger resolves before the Goblin Half-Heart trigger, I believe, because you activated Goblin Half-Heart's ability.
Right, but you floated a bunch of red.
Oh, well, okay.
Resolve the Mana Echoes triggers before you make more goblins.
Oh, Adam's looking to get damage off the sacrifice.
You can do them sequentially. Yeah, this can work.
Yeah, no, you can use so the goblins come in and you use those to pay for the next mountains that you sacrifice and make more goblins.
Leading to some horrible chain reaction.
So that's pretty sweet. My second one is Shared Animosity, which is another enchantment. It costs 2 and a red, and whenever a creature you control attacks, it gets +1/+0 until end of turn for each other attacking creature that shares a creature type with it. So when you've got 1,000,000 goblins and they all have to attack and everyone has to block and then they can sack to deal damage to blockers, your guys are getting pretty big. They're going to be trading up in the world.
Yeah, they're kind of screwed no matter what they choose to do at that point if you have enough goblins. Man, this kind of went sideways. This deck actually is kind of starting to sound pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds awesome.
I think I might actually build this. I'm serious. This sounds like fun. Okay. So, that's our first Entourage segment. Ib Half-Heart Goblin Deck.
We broke it.
I think this deck sounds like fun. I think this deck's going to be ballin', and I'm going to build it. And if you guys see me out there, I'm gonna try to build a helmet as well. It looks like his. I think a role-playing element would be appropriate for this deck.
Right. So, and stick your tongue out, Cray. You know.
Yeah. So y'all be on the watch. I'm going to be out there doing my Thug Thizzle in half-heart style with a gangsta. You know, I'll be holding my mountain sideways. Shit's going to be a jump off. All right. So that's it for Entourage. So if you guys like this segment, suggest upcoming generals for it. If you have a general that you think would be cool to see what we can come up with, because I think we had a pretty solid brewing session here. I don't want to, you know, say that I'm good, because that we all know that's not true, but these were actually some pretty cool ideas. So let's see where this can go. Send in some more obscure generals that you think might be interesting. Don't send in something that's worthless.
Arkham Dagson might be really good. What do you guys think about that?
You know what? I have no idea. Do people build around him?
I think maybe if you got Winter Orb or Mycosynth Lattice, that could be really good.
Right.
Because I don't know. I'd see him and I'd be like, let's just leave him. You know, let's spread the love. You know, whatever. Anyway. If you guys have, you know, underplayed generals like Arkham Dagson, then send in your suggestions and we'll do our best with them. So that's it for Entourage. Ibhot, a half heart, let's get it. Everyone should be building this deck. I want to see, you know, multiple copies all over the internet within a week. And next, we're going to move on to Trinket Mage versus Treasure Mage. Oh, wow. And that was it for our first ever Entourage. That was Season 2, Episode 6. Ib Halfheart is top tier. And that also concludes the Commander Cast Sampler episode. Thanks for listening up to this point, and if you've liked what you've been hearing, there's a very good chance that you'll also like the rest of our back catalog, which you can find over at CommanderCast.com under our content index. You can also find the podcast on QuietSpeculation.com and MTGCast.com. Now, to continue to mirror the structure of a regular Commander Cast episode, we always give contact information at the end of the show. If you want to get a hold of me, my email is CommanderCast@gmail.com. And I'm at CommanderCast on Twitter as well. You can leave a comment on CommanderCast.com for just about any episode that we've ever released, and we'll probably see that and get back to you about it. As well, don't forget that CommanderCast.com has more than just a podcast. Monday through Friday, we do update with articles, videos, and links to our external affiliate sites, which you'd really be remiss to not check out. Again, CommanderCast is available weekly. It is produced in blocks of 13 episodes called seasons. And between seasons, we take a 3-week break off. So if you head over to CommanderCast.com and it seems like nothing's been posted in a while, don't worry. It's probably just that we're in between seasons right now, where nothing is posted on the website while we give the staff an opportunity to kind of recharge their batteries and make sure that the content quality stays up to par and that everything stays nice and fresh. So again, thanks for listening to this sampler episode, and head over to CommanderCast.com every week for a new dose of community, strategy, and technology.